Shalom. Welcome. On Conversations today, we are going to speak with Noel Pugash with his association with the New Mexico Jewish Historical Society. Noel's been around Albuquerque for 40 plus years, so there's many, many things we could speak about. But today, that there's a rich Jewish presence history as part of the history of the state and the West in general. And we're going to have several of these conversations. Today is the first with Noel. And so welcome to the program.
Thank you, Matthew.
Where do we begin? Well, first let's just say you've been here a while, 40
yes.
plus years.
Right.
A New Yorker by birth, spent your life as a professional educator.
Right.
And does that bring us up to today?
Well, I do a lot of other things. I taught at the University of New Mexico full-time, 38 and a half years. I retired in 2006, Professor Emeritus. But I still go back and teach occasionally. My specialties, because they have not hired people in my fields really, number one, U.S. foreign relations, and two, Jewish history. I've taught Jewish history at the University of New Mexico for years, regular credit courses.
When did you first become interested in that course of study and then teaching?
Okay. Well, I've always been interested in Judaic. I've had an extensive Jewish education, quite extensive. And
does that mean in New York you went to the yeshiva and all that? Or
I went to a yeshiva. I went to Herzliya Teachers Institute in Manhattan for a number of years while I was going to Brooklyn College for my undergraduate degree. I have other forms of Jewish education. So, my former colleague, late colleague, Gunther Rothenberg, who taught at University of New Mexico for many years, introduced a course on Jewish history in the early 1970s. And then he left and went to Purdue, and he urged me to keep it going. I was just starting out and was more concerned about finishing my book so I can get tenure, promotion, and the like, do those things that assistant professors are required to do, especially if you want to stay around. People like to eat, right. And so I postponed it. But once I got promoted, got tenure, I began to think of it, and so I started to teach Gunther's course. And the problem with Gunther's course was he tried to do everything in one semester, which I felt was impossible. So I made it a two-semester course and alternated between my teaching U.S. foreign relations and Jewish history. And then, in the 80s, catching up with the rest of the country, I introduced a course on the Holocaust, which I give fairly often. I draw a lot of students to that.
Was that difficult to get approved?
No.
Okay.
My department has been supportive. The university has been supportive. So I never had any problems getting these courses approved.
Well, coming from a very Semitic part of the world, you know, Manhattan, Brooklyn, ultimately, 40 plus years ago, ending up in Albuquerque, did you go, I'm involved in the Jewish part of my life. What am I going to be able to fulfill that as well as my career goals in Albuquerque?
Much harder. I mean, I came from a family that was very Jewish in a way. They were traditional. They observed certain things, other things they didn't. My grandparents on both sides were Orthodox. My parents weren't. I was exposed to a number of different parts of the Jewish world. I did go to a yeshiva, a Jewish religious school, for a number of years during high school. So I learned Talmud, and I learned some other things. But then I had a broader interest and sort of, in a way, rebelled against the traditional yeshiva university. So I studied at Herzliya Teachers Institute, which was a very, at one time, was a very good institution. When I went, it was declining. But it taught Judaica from a more scientific, critical standpoint.
Okay.
And that exposed me to another side of Jewish life. And today, of course, we have a proliferation of Jewish education studies at many universities. There are a variety of institutions now that offer such courses, and one can therefore study Judaism and Judaica and Jewish history from a traditional Orthodox standpoint. One can do this from a critical, almost secular standpoint.
Right. And at the time when you were growing up, was it a kind of a mixed neighborhood, or was it more of a all-Jewish neighborhood?
It was a very Jewish neighborhood.
So you could get a decent bagel?
You can get a decent bagel and a very good deli, and I sometimes thirst for both, and I had my deli kick answered. I just got back from San Francisco, and at the museum, the Contemporary Jewish Museum, there's a very good deli, so I had my corned beef sandwich.
Is there any place in Albuquerque or Santa Fe or within 50 miles that you would like to say makes a good bagel?
A really good bagel.
A New York bagel.
No.
Okay.
There are...
I haven't found one.
There are facsimiles.
Okay.
Shall we say?
Cheap imitations.
They're not cheap.
No. No bagels are...
They're imitations.
Yes.
Right, even if they boil them.
Yes. The New Mexico Jewish Historical Society has been around how long?
It was chartered in the 1980s and based almost entirely in Santa Fe at the time. The founders were virtually all Santa Feans. And it faltered for a while, and then in the late 1990s, it revived, and I think it's on a good upswing. Our programs are very rich. People can find out about them if they check the website of the New Mexico Jewish Historical Society.
Yes. And
NMJHS at jewishnewmexico.org.
And there's a lot of information out there, and as you said, there's a lot of programs to go see and to learn. Is around 1980 when the organization formed? Is that when the JCC was built?
No, this was, as I said, it had nothing to do with the building of the JCC. Right now, the New Mexico Jewish Historical Society has a home, sort of, an office at the Jewish Community Center in Wyoming. In New Albuquerque. But it originally was founded in Santa Fe.
Right.
And for a number of years, there was a certain amount of tension between Santa Fe and Albuquerque as far as where should the programs be held. So generally, we tried balance, all right?
Right.
Try to have them in both communities. The Albuquerque community is much larger than the Santa Fe community, but in some cases, the support we get in Santa Fe is a little more vigorous. You have to realize Santa Fe was the first and oldest real Jewish community in Albuquerque, in New Mexico. In New Mexico,
founded around when?
Well, Santa Fe goes back to, of course, the 1590s.
Right.
But the first true Jew, genuine, there was various claims for others. Solomon Jacob Spiegelberg arrived in 1845 or 1846.
He sounds Jewish to me.
Yes, there are some others that are supposedly Jewish, a man by the name of Speyer, but there's no evidence that he, hard evidence, he was buried in a Christian cemetery.
Right. That's kind of an interesting switch. Very often through history, Jews had to kind of hide the Judaism, and now you're saying some people are claiming to be Jews and they really weren't.
Well, he never claimed. It's as far as I know, he never publicly claimed that. See, there's a problem in the popular mind because the bulk of Jewish immigrants to New Mexico in the 19th century came from Germany, overwhelmingly from Germany, that if it's a German name, it's Jewish. Well, that is simply not true. And Speyer, there are many Jews who have the family name of Speyer, S-P-E-Y-E-R, but they weren't Jews. And we have to realize there's a large, there was a large, pretty vigorous German Gentile population in New Mexico. One of the most prominent of these people was Franz Uning, who built Uning Castle in right. Albuquerque, very prominent merchant. In fact, one German Jew did partner with Uning Freudenthal for a couple of years in stores south of Albuquerque. And then there were a number of others. Well, so just because it's a German-sounding name doesn't mean, or it ends in Berg, right. It doesn't mean they're Jewish.
And there's some tricky ones like Schumacher or Shoemaker.
Right.
You could go either way.
It could go either way. Yeah. And there's a, you know, in the East, in New York, where I grew up, well, if someone had the name of Schwartz, must be Jewish. No. Right.
No, not at all. No.
A lot of Schwartzes are not Jewish.
Or in Schwartzes without the TZ.
Right, yeah. Swartz, yeah. Swartz.
All right, well, let's roll back the hands of time to
okay.
when, if there is such a date, it, first documented Jewish person in New Mexico, or community.
All right, now you see, I don't want to get involved in the crypto-Jewish question, but one could argue,
let's define crypto-Jews for
all
people.
All right. Those Jews who were forcibly converted to Catholicism in Spain and later on in Portugal, but who continued to maintain Jewish practices as long as they could. These people, beginning in 1391, there were mass forced conversions in Spain. And the next century was a very difficult and cruel one for Jews, and the Jewish population with Spain in Spain was huge. Some estimates going to 200,000. But they were a very large, important part of the population that went back to the period even before the Common Era.
Right.
Some claim that the first Jews came to Iberia in the first century BCE. Over time, they developed a very large, strong Jewish population, different than most of the ancestors of American Jews in that they were Sephardic. Sephard is the Hebrew name for Spain. So, if you were from Spain, then you were a Sephardic Jew.
Different customs.
Different customs. In terms of religious observance, pretty much the same.
Right.
The prayer book is a little different. Some of the rituals are different. But the many customs are different. The foods are different. So Sephardic Jewry developed in the atmosphere, the environment of Iberia, and took on a number of its characteristics. Ashkenazic Jews, those Ashkenaz in Hebrew means German, had settled in the Rhineland and in Western Europe, and they had their own customs and their own practices. The Sephardic Jews spoke their own language, Patois, that was called, some call it Ladino, that's really have to be careful there. But they spoke a form of combination of Hebrew and Spanish, all right?
Kind of like what some of us speak as Spanglish.
Sort of, okay. Whereas Ashkenazic Jews spoke a variety of German, Yiddish, the major language of East European Jews, was grammatically German, High German, 13th, 14th century German, written in Hebrew characters with a lot of Hebrew words, but also Russian and Polish, because as Jews moved, they incorporated words into that language, as we incorporate English.
So, Noel, you were saying that the Yiddish was part of the Ashkenazi Jews,
right.
The
and Judeo European. And Judeo-Spanish was the common language of Sephardic Jews.
So if I went to Spain today, hanging out with Sephardim, you know, Spanish Jews, and tossed in a Yiddish word, would they look at me like, I don't know what you're talking about?
Well, some Yiddish words have become so popular,
well,
everyone uses them. But they would look at you and say, I'm sorry, I don't understand. That word.
That's something new to me. That's interesting.
Well, okay, and so those. Now you have to realize, for so many years, there were no Jews living openly in Spain. It's only in the 20th century that Jews were allowed to return to Spain.
So, we're not going to talk about the crypto Jews. We're going to do that in a future episode.
Right, and I think there are people who are more expert on it, and I have
hard to believe. You get my vote.
No, so I have some questions about it. Right. But anyway, I think.
So, which folks came to New Mexico?
Okay, so the people who first came, who were really Jewish, were German Jewish immigrants. And many of them. Most of the German Jews settled on the East Coast. Of course, you settle where you land. And you don't have money and you don't know much about the country. So they got to New York or Philadelphia or Baltimore. Baltimore is a big port receiving immigrants too, by the way. It had developed a large Jewish population. You stayed there.
And around what date was this?
Well, the first German Jews came as early as the 18th century, but their numbers were small. Now, the first Jews who came to the United States were Sephardic Jews.
Okay.
All right.
They were coming for religious freedom, as many other Americans?
They were coming for religious freedom to escape persecution. The first Jews in what becomes the United States were 24 Jews who fled from Brazil because Portugal had reconquered Brazil and from the Dutch. The Dutch allowed Jews to come out of their cover and to practice Judaism openly. And so they were fleeing from Brazil, and they wound up in New York.
And there were 24
of
them?
24 at first.
And they were documented. We know who those 24
were.
Well,
yes, we know who they were.
Right? Well, how come, Hollywood hasn't made some blockbuster movie called 24, I live with a TV show 24, but 24 Jews.
I don't know.
We'll have to write this.
All right. But then more came from the West Indies, from the and then from Holland and England, which first welcomed these Jews into their countries. A number of these Jews, crypto Jews, settled in Holland, which had thrown off Spanish rule, and adopted not full scale, but pretty much religious toleration.
But the ones who were in the Caribbean, the Dutch West Indies. They were probably part of the Dutch West Indies Corporation.
Exactly, or some from in the British colonies in the West Indies.
And there was religious persecution?
No, by and large, there wasn't.
Why did they come here?
They came because there seemed to be greater opportunities in this new country, all right, this new world, the mainland British colony.
They weren't part of the big gold rush or anything like that.
They came in small numbers.
Look,
at the time of the American Revolution, there were perhaps 2,000 Jews in all of the United States. So you had 13 million non-Jews and 2,000 Jews in the English colony. By that time,
that's half of Bernalillo. That's like nobody.
By that time, England had adopted religious toleration, mainly as a need to preserve peace within England. You may be familiar with the terrible religious wars between Catholics and Protestants in England.
Kind of hard to miss.
Hard of Bloody Mary, and, you know, so if a Protestant ruled, then the Catholics got it. If a Catholic ruled, then the Protestants got it. All right. Officially, there were no Jews in England ever since they were kicked out in 1290 by Edward the First.
What was his reason, as opposed to just killing them?
They were prejudice, anti-Semitism, mm-hmm. anti-Judaism. Mm-hmm. It had been growing in Europe, and it affected England as well. And the Jews were no longer important to the economy, and after Edward and his predecessors bled them, they were of no use. Before, they had played an important role in the in England.
Right. And that fate has beset many different groups.
Right. Okay, that's true. Yeah. So, but England opened up in the 17th century and adopted the Act of Religious Toleration. So, Jews who came to the English colonies were pretty safe from persecution. Not all. There were various forms of it, even in so-called liberal Rhode Island. But anyway.
So, they're in the different ports, Baltimore, New York, maybe some are still in Florida.
No, they weren't in there.
That was much later.
Yes.
So who said, hey, let's go to New Mexico? Or was it just part of the pioneers going west?
Part of the process of Americans going west and finding opportunity. Right. And so the Santa Fe Trail is opened up in the 1820s. So you can go from Missouri. Independence, Missouri is where the Santa Fe Trail really began. And it was long. It was dangerous. You had the Indians. You had the terrible weather, disease, and so forth.
Highwaymen,
exactly. And when you got to New Mexico, which was then a province of Mexico, you were not really welcome, all right, because the Mexicans limited trade and limited who would settle. And in theory, you had to be a Catholic.
So it was purely a welcome if you're Catholic.
That's right.
And they could probably tell back then.
Well, it's interesting that Texas was first settled by mainly Americans. Spain had opened up Texas because it feared that all this vacant land would encourage American Protestants to come in, and Spain would lose it. Mexico, which declared independence in 1821 from Spain, had the same worries. So really the policy was instituted first officially by Mexico. So you encourage settlers to serve as a buffer against the United States, which was this expanding empire. One of the conditions was you had to be a Catholic. So here you have these Kentuckians and Tennesseans who were willing to, you know, outwardly be Catholic in order to get land. And that's what motivated them. So New Mexico is not welcoming of these because there are all sorts of taxes and restrictions on trade, which put the New Mexicans at a disadvantage because they had to get their goods all the way from Mexico City or, you know, other places further north, Chihuahua. They were very expensive, the taxes were very heavy. And so they welcomed these Americans who were aggressive. And meanwhile, fur traders came in because they heard of the great wealth of the furs, pelts in the Rockies. And so they're up in Colorado. They come down to New Mexico. Some of them go to Taos and set up a trading operations there. So people come on this Santa Fe Trail. First Americans. And they report back, and there's business, good business, and opportunities, and so forth. But the real change, and some Jews heard about it too. Solomon Jacob Spiegelberg who was the first certifiable Jew who comes to New Mexico, he may have come as early as 1845. More likely, perhaps, 1846. Now, Spiegelberg had come from Germany in the 1840s, seeking opportunity. And there were other things that pushed German Jews to the United States. One was deep-seated anti-Semitism. And by the 1840s, there had been another wave of persecution in many of the German states. There was the so-called Hep-Hep movement, led by religious fanatics that wanted to eliminate Jews from the German states. There's no Germany, let's remember, until 1870.
Right.
All right. So, Napoleon had brought some amount of freedom to the areas that he conquered in Germany and occupied. Once Napoleon was defeated, there was a reaction against these liberal tendencies, including giving rights to Jews. The famous banker Rothschild was forced to go back to the ghetto in Frankfurt after Napoleon was kicked out. So for a while they were given rights, and then they're kicked out. France is the first nation in Europe to give Jews full citizenship, full rights. So anyway, but Europe becomes violently anti-Semitic. And part of it is faith and tradition and the fact that the Jews rejected Jesus and they won't accept this new faith, which the adherents thought was the one true faith. Then there were other factors that contributed to the growth of anti-Judaism. One was economic. Right? Jews are forced off the land in most of Europe. They can't be farmers. And remember, Jews were originally, the Hebrews were farmers.
Right.
Right? They were not businessmen. They learned business from the Greeks and commerce from the Greeks. And then, you know, developed their own, you know, strong inclinations in the field of commerce. So Jews are forced into marginal occupations, including pawnbroking, money lending, things of that sort. The church had condemned money lending, charging interest. Jews for survival, became money lenders, and Jews would fulfill roles on the margins of the economy for many, many years because they were rejected from, you know, Jews were in crafts before. They were artisans. But once the church takes over that, Jews are kicked out of a lot of the crafts.
In this roller coaster ride in the different countries, we're talking about decades or centuries.
Centuries. Right. Okay. So anyway, so why do these German Jews come? They come because a lot of them suffer from anti-Semitism. Restrictions on their occupations. Those won't end until well into the 19th century. They come because a number of them don't want to go into the army. They're forced conscription. And why? Because it's almost impossible to be a Jew and be in the army.
Sure.
All right? I mean, they're traditional. They observe the dietary laws and all of that. They, you know, really don't want to work on the Sabbath if they come from a traditional background.
And at that point in history, if you are a practicing Jew, you're probably what we would consider very observant now.
Right. But that changes in Germany and then the United States with the development of Reform Judaism. So, and then they come for opportunity, like so many other Europeans, because Germany experiences hard times in the 1820s and 30s. They look for livelihoods.
Right. So the first group, and then, I'm only pushing you ahead because we have a limited amount of time.
All right.
And I wanted at least in chapter one touch a little bit on where were the first communities and first synagogues and all that kind of stuff? Where could you go get a good challah?
You couldn't. Your wife baked it.
That's okay. Good point.
All right. So anyway, and there's one final factor that brought some Jews to the United States, and that was the failure of the liberal revolutions of 1848. And Jews played an important role in these revolutions. And just as German Christian liberals had to leave, there's Jews left too. So they come to the United States for a variety of reasons. And one of the things that pulls a few, don't forget it's a few, to New Mexico is opportunity. Now, that opportunity came about when the United States conquered New Mexico in the Mexican-American War of 1846-48. So, Solomon Jacob Spiegelberg, in fact, may have come along with Kearney, who led an army into New Mexico and then went on to conquer California. He may have come as a provisioner, as a sutler, S-U-T-L-E-R, which was the term used, someone who supplied the army. Armies have great needs. They have to eat, they need shoes, they need clothes, they need all sorts of goods, and so...
Like weapons?
Weapons, exactly. So
hard to have a good war without some bullets.
Spiegelberg settled in New York for a while, in Philadelphia for a few months. He learned some English, he learned something about American business, and then he goes on to St. Louis. And he probably clerked for a German Gentile by the name of Leitensdorfer. And so he gains more experience. Here he's on the western frontier. Missouri is still very western and the like. And he comes to New Mexico. Kearney has conquered New Mexico. There are all sorts of opportunities. Meanwhile, he also, we send an army down to Mexico to conquer Mexico, to put pressure on Mexico to surrender. We didn't want all of Mexico, really. We wanted Texas. We wanted California. All right? And New Mexico now.
Did they want New Mexico for any other reason other than it connected Texas to California?
That's a major factor.
Okay.
All right.
Good
right.
to be loved.
Right. And there were rumors of mineral wealth, silver and gold in New Mexico. But the primary reason was continuity and contiguity of territory.
Okay.
So, Spielberg comes. He may have followed the army into Mexico that reached Chihuahua as a sutler. He may have fought. We're not sure if he actually fought against Mexico. But he comes back, and now he has experience. He's accumulated some capital. And he sets up his own general store on the plaza in Santa Fe.
This is Spiegelberg.
This is Spiegelberg.
Is this the guy who started the Spiegel catalog?
No.
Okay.
So he comes here.
Would have been a good story.
And he's now Americans are starting to come into New Mexico. New Mexico is freed of all of those restrictions on trade. It's part of the American economy. There's opportunities. And he sees them. And so he probably goes back east where he has relatives, contacts, and buys goods, accumulates some more capital, and he establishes this general store that does very well in Santa Fe. Meanwhile, he needs help, so he encourages his brothers to come. And I think he had seven brothers, and four or five of them come to New Mexico.
And were they doing some kind of...
They work for him.
But in New York, were they merchants also, or...?
Well, some of them came directly to New Mexico. See, that's something that is a factor, you know, throughout the 19th century. Some... When they have a relative in New Mexico that says, I'll give you a job, you know, you can work in my store, so they come directly to New Mexico. But a number of them get seasoned by living elsewhere in the United States, New York, Philadelphia, some in St. Louis. So
they learn the language,
they learn the culture. They learn a little of the language, and then as soon as they come to New Mexico, they have to learn another language, Spanish, and they're very good at it. See, Jews have had a facility with languages and a willingness to learn languages because they're thrown into various environments, and you got to learn the language. If you're going to transact business, you'd have to know Spanish in New Mexico.
Well, I think the operative word that you used, Noel, was willingness. Where the Jewish community has gotten put or ran to, they learned how to integrate.
Right, and many of them came from in multilingual families where, yes, they knew Hebrew, well, it was the religious language, the language of prayer, Yiddish, especially in Eastern Europe, and then for survival, Russian and Polish and Czech and so forth.
Okay. And so where is Mr. Spiegelberg's store?
It's on the plaza in Santa Fe.
Okay.
And then
any notation of it? Its presence today, little plaque, nothing.
No. Well, I think there's a plaque. Maybe, I don't know.
Okay. It's a Starbucks now or something.
Okay. But then his relatives, Abraham and Sadok Staub, S-T-A-A-B, come to Santa Fe, and boy, they see opportunity too. And so they come. And Amsbergs and Ellsberg, cousins of the Spiegelbergs, come. That's a very important factor that brings Jews to New Mexico. If one relative comes here and succeeds, then he's going to serve as a magnet for others. He needs help.
And we see that in other cultures when someone gets settled,
The Italians, the same thing.
Right.
The Greeks, the same thing. You encourage your relatives to come.
Right.
And they do. And then the word spreads that one can make a good living. Not everyone became successful in New Mexico. And I want to point out something. We know about those people who were successful. We don't know about the failures. All right? Because they didn't leave a trace. So some of them couldn't take New Mexico. They were lonely for more Jews. They went back east. Some hear about the opportunities in California, of course, and they go out to California for their fortunes.
And even as primitive by today's standards that the East Coast would have been, New Mexico was degrees more rustic.
Of course.
It's not for everybody.
And its life is tough.
Yeah. I don't know if I could have done it.
A lot of people could, and a lot of people could not survive long in this environment. So, but the word spreads, and several, I'm talking about dozens at first, Jews come to New Mexico. Now, Santa Fe starts to decline. I can talk about the Spiegelbergs a long time. They remain prominent. They become major wholesalers in New Mexico. They set up branches all over. They supply the U.S. Army. They are provisioners for the Army. In fact, many of these Jews and a few non-Jews become settlers to the Army. The Army needs supplies. Then once the U.S. conquers the tribes in New Mexico that resist, then many signed treaties and were forced to supply them with X amount of goods a year, grain and other things.
Right.
It's part of these treaties. And so Jews get into the business of supplying the Indians as well.
And are there any historical stories of Jews forming big relationships with Native Americans?
Yes. All right. I'll talk.
That's probably better for the next time.
Yeah, maybe the next time. Okay. But you have to realize one reason why it was so attractive to supply the army and to supply the tribes is you got paid in cash. There is no...
Paper money or gold and silver?
Gold and silver, but
there's
some cash. Uncle Sam can pay you in cash. The rest of New Mexico is largely a barter economy.
Right.
All right? So, now this is interesting because this is how these general stores become very successful and their owners become very rich, wealthy, as the Spiegelbergs and the Staubs, for example, because you can't expect cash. These people pay you with their crop. So you give it the goods on credit. You get the beans, the frijoles, and the like, sheep and the like, wool, and so forth. And you sell those in the eastern markets.
Right.
So you become, in a way, this leads to merchant capitalism in New Mexico. And you find that elsewhere on the frontier. At first, there's almost no cash.
Well, it's like now, when a container comes from overseas, you don't send it back empty, you fill it up and
right,
send it
exactly,
back.
Exactly. So, but the advantage of supplying Uncle Sam is that while Uncle Sam may delay payment for a while, he does pay him, all right? And he gives you IOUs.
Right.
Now, you can use those IOUs to get goods elsewhere.
So they are transferable.
They are transferable, okay? So, you may have to discount them to the person who will take the note, but, you know, you have to give him 20% off because he has to wait 6 months to get his paper.
Well, it's
right?
Like bond trading now.
Exactly. And, yeah, okay. So,
you short sell the U.S. IOU.
So, the Spiegelbergs and the Staubs and a couple others spread out their operations all over the territory of New Mexico. Spiegelberg sends a relative, Zeckendorf, to Albuquerque to open a store here. Zeckendorf opens his own store, too. The Staubs have operations all over the territory. And, as I said, both Spiegelbergs and Staubs become major wholesalers. Then, meanwhile, people hear about New Mexico, and they start going to other communities. Now, one that grows very rapidly is Las Vegas, particularly after the arrival of the railroad in 1879.
Right. Our Las Vegas, not Las Vegas. Nevada.
Exactly.
Okay.
All right.
And that?
1879, railroad comes to Las Vegas, and boy, that changes everything.
And that's where we're going to wrap it up for today.
We're going to wrap it up together.
So,
and there's so much to say about Las Vegas. And
we shall.
And the biggest, the most important merchant who becomes the leading wholesaler in New Mexico is Charles Ilfeld and the Charles Ilfeld Company.
Excellent. Well, Noel Pugash, I can't thank you enough. We're just touching the tip of the iceberg here. So as we knew going in, the history of Jews in New Mexico is amazing. Noel, thank you so much. Obviously, there's a lot here to appreciate, whether you're Jewish or New Mexican or just...
Right.
So for Conversations with Matthew Bronson on KUPR 99.9 FM here in the high desert of Placidas, this has been a conversation with Noel Pugash of the New Mexico Jewish Historical Society, and we're going to have many conversations about that whole topic. So thank you.